This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we have an unusual story to tell, but of course, that's what we do. This is about UFOs, because that's also one of the things we do. And it's a different look at everything. We have a guest today, Mike Fiorito. Mike has been working in the UFO world for a long time, and he comes to it from a perspective that I see as being absolutely unique. Mike, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks so much for having me on, Whitley. It's good to see you again. It's been about a year since the last book, so thank you. Thanks for having me.
The last book, this book, okay, folks, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a level of communication, I think is the best way to put it, a level of meaning, UFOs and music. Okay, I'm laying it out there. There's something here that involves sound. Mm-hmm. And when I first picked up this book, I have to tell you, I went all the way back to the Neanderthals and the idea that they may have communicated only in musical tones because they didn't have the vocal cords to make speech. Mm-hmm. And then I thought to myself, the visitors can't make speech either. They make these beautiful, extraordinary sounds. I've heard. I talk about this in the Fourth Mind. And I thought, Mike's onto something here. He's onto something big. So I'm pretty excited. Tell us, how did you get to UFOs and music? Let's just start there and see where we go.
Well, first of all, thank you so much. I'm glad that it's exciting to me that people have picked up on this, because it is, frankly, when I looked into the literature and I've read a lot of, you know, our colleagues' work, and frankly, I haven't found anything that dug into this subject deeply enough, not in an anecdotal way. And I did not want this to be anecdotal. I wanted it to be narrative. I wanted there to be research. Also, there's a lot of layers of research, and I'll talk about that. So first of all, as you know, Whitley, so I'm a musician, I'm a music journalist. I'm deeply interested in music. So, you know, I listen to music like you. We both share a common interest in certain genres. And one of the things that occurred to me is that there is some communication that's happening in music, and it's multi-layered. You know, you can take music, it's like you take a big, you know, iceberg structure, and you could hear music at the utmost top layer, and you could hear it as, you know, just something pleasant, something you do while you vacuum, you know. But that the deeper you go into the strata and the layers of music, there's a lot of unconscious unpacking that can happen. I mean, and it's in its most prosaic way, music, it's a transport system, you know, ironically, like the UFOs are always flying places, right? The phenomena seems to be always on the move. And music is like that. It is a transport system. I do think that there's in the bits of music itself, there's something communicated. And this thing came to me through various, you know, inputs. You walk outside, you know, I live in New York City. I live very close to Prospect Park. In the spring, you have the proliferation of birds. And suddenly you have this boom of bird song. And I swear, I don't know how you feel. When I hear a bird song, I feel like they're saying something. I am not sophisticated enough to understand it.
Oh, I think you're right. I think the musical notes they create with their syrinxes are very, very subtle and complex. There have been a lot of studies of that, and I think they're saying a lot more than mm-hmm. we realize. The visitors don't have a syrinx, or vocal cords, so they can only make a noise. They can go, oh, but it's Really, it's the I heard just I've heard the six cries, three two cries, three two groups of three cries at separate instances. And the first group I heard were the most extraordinary sounds I have ever heard. I never forget those three cries. In fact, that's why I'm so eager to talk about this book. We're going to get into all kinds of things, telepathy, and it's just an amazing story here. Anyway, those three cries were so perfect, so perfectly spaced, the tones were so perfect that I couldn't stand, I could not hear music for a year. I listened to a lot of classical music, I'm embarrassed to say, to those of you who are rock fans, and I am something of a rock fan, but Bach and my classical stuff just sounded muddy after hearing those tones.
Interesting. And are you able to, some people have perfect pitch, so they can hear a tone and they know what it is. They know it's an A, they know it's a B.
No, I don't have
They
perfect pitch. I wish I
Yeah.
did, but the notes were, they opened something up in me so deep that a few
Right.
minutes later, I went back into my babyhood and relived the moment I first walked. People know
Wow.
the story, but it is, it just, and that's why I thought when I saw the book, I thought he's definitely onto something.
One thing that I discovered in writing the book, and I'll get to that, is that there was nothing monolithic. What you said, that you had this profound experience of hearing, you heard the visitors make tones. This, many people have this, but not everybody has this. Some of it is a silent experience. And it, even if it's telepathic, it could still be musical, as it was in your case. The story that you're referring to, again, is not a monolithic story. It's a story about how my son was born. And I was walking, I was living on the Upper East Side, and I'm walking down the street, and there are these two young men playing guitars. And they're kind of, this is like 1995 or four. Kind of typical looking, scruffy haired, young guys playing guitar, but one guy's playing was just extraordinary. And it was about maybe 3 seconds that I heard his playing. And he's Russian. He's become a friend of mine. And Peter's mother is a famous novelist in Russia. And in 3 seconds, he played about 12 notes, and those notes really caught me. This was not typical. This was like Rachmaninoff or something. You said you like classical music. He plays in a kind of rock guitar format, but he's not that. Anyway, it caught my attention. Here I am just ambling by, gonna pass them by, but I stopped, talked to him, and he became a good friend and introduced me to my ex-wife. But
Wow,
my
that's very
point of
incredible on the streets of New York. Wow.
yeah, it was like a net. And what I tried to do in the book is to, I didn't want to say the same story over and over again. If you're familiar with Orfeo Angelucci wrote a book in the 50s or 60s. It's a great book on his experience with the visitors. And what he says is, he had multiple encounters. He was invited aboard a ship, something that's very common. The capsule looks kind of small, but when you walk in, it's gigantic. It's like the size of a cathedral. So there's that strange breakdown of dimension, of physical dimension. And
You
then
know
he
what
described,
happens then?
what's that?
You're walking into another world. I think you're on
Right?
another in another world. You're not,
Yeah.
it is the ship is a portal. And when you step into it, you step across the portal, presumably onto another planet, even possibly. I mean, you could be
Yeah.
billions of miles away.
Yeah, I agree. And although I can't say that I entertain a lot of ideas about what these things mean, it seems that we intersect other dimensions. And even the way that happens very commonly, what happens when I step on grass, as and that there are birds on the grass and there are insects, and how do they experience my intrusion upon their world? Why wouldn't it be that there are other worlds that other beings likewise intersect with ours, and there's some what is perceived by us is something very different by them, by their experience.
Well, of course, and
Yeah.
especially if they're outside of time looking in, their whole relationship to reality is completely different.
And I think, music is a, you talked about close encounters. It's a deliteralized way of communicating. I think what music does, it takes us out of our ego. And we're kind of caught up in our egocentric kind of everyday reality. All of us are. I mean, I'm who isn't for the most part. But when we have those incursions, when we have that kind of ontological shock that can come in different in come in different forms, our perception widens a bit and increases. And I know that music can do that. And if you'll notice in the stories that I wrote, it wasn't that it was one way. So sometimes it's out of music that an experience can unfold. Sometimes there's the experience of the visitors, there's the encounter experience, then music occurs. As in the case of Orfeo, and I discovered him through Jung. Jung wrote about him. And what he said is he walked into this, spaceship, let's call it, and there were beings aboard the spaceship. And there's this gigantic, kind of incredible sized, almost cathedral rooms, with all of these interesting technological and geometric objects and surfaces. But then he hears this lush music, kind of like what you described, this most beautiful music, symphonic music. And what I found is in my discussions with other people, he wasn't the only one to experience that. So it's not always happening. Some people have an encounter, and it's kind of opposite, maybe. It's this gigantic thing, this craft, let's say, and it's as big as a house, and it's 20 feet away from you, and it's awesome, but it's silent. So it's not that it's one thing. I think music, when I've read lots of your work, music is a part of the mystery. We don't know why we do it. We just don't know.
One of the things that happens when one of those craft draws near is everything becomes silent. The birds stop singing. There is a you're like in a an area of complete silence. Awesome. It's very awesome. And it's sometimes you can hear the craft. You can actually hear it making
Humming.
an And if it gets really slow and comes down, it starts clanking kind of. But before that, it'll go. It makes a noise that you can feel in your teeth. And all the birds and everything's silent.
Right. And I've asked people that have had that experience. So I talked to different people, and I got their testimony. So I spoke to people based on when my first, it's not my first book, it was my first UFO themed book that came out. People wrote to me. I had a lot of, questions come to me through my website and so on, and they wanted to tell me their story. And one woman had an experience where she's a neurologist. She's a medical doctor. She lives her life in a by data by in the kind of ordinary consensus materialist way. But she lives near Fermilab, and she said one night this sound came over her house, and it was a loud hum, like a electronic magnetic thing, and it shuddered the house too, and her son heard it as well. But it was this kind of terrifying thing that kind of came over, lingered over her house, and it just kind of, magnetic shudder and pull, but there was a musical quality to it. You'll notice that the name of the book is UFO Symphonic Journeys into Sound. So I began looking at it as just music. Let's look at the connection between music and the UFO phenomena. And you know what I mean when I say UFO phenomena. I'm not just talking about UFOs. It could be Marian apparitions. It could be sightings. It's the full scope of the experience. But what I learned, there was more than just music. It could be just the phenomena could manifest, or we could be drawn into it through sound.
I
So
think
for
that's important because
yeah.
I think it's quite true. That silence is some. There's something. At times it feels a little ominous, and other times
Yeah.
it maybe there's a sacredness to it. It feels so profound. It's not like a normal silence. It's something else. It's a sacred silence. That's what it is.
Right, and it probably has musical qualities to it in some way that would be an interesting line of inquiry. I think what I've done is I've kind of scratched the surface and I've covered a lot of ground. You'll notice, Whitley, that I looked into musicology. I looked into folklore, to mythology, to I even went into anthropology. There was a lot of research that was involved in this because there's not one way to solve this, to answer this. I think we started at the beginning. Where does music come from? So we think that early humans were singing to each other.
That's right. There's even a book about the Neanderthals and song,
Singing Neanderthal.
singing Neanderthals, and the visitors are unvoiced. They don't, and they're therefore also they're telepathic. They're very telepathic. In fact, when you're with them, you're telepathic, and it's easy. It seems like the most natural thing in the world. Then you leave their presence, and suddenly you're not telepathic anymore. But that's the way they communicate. And is there a music there somehow? Because their voices are, those sounds that they make, the cries they make are so complex. I wish I could have recorded that sound that I heard back in those days when the three cries I referred to many times before, and in my books I've mentioned. But I was nowhere near a chance to record
Of
them,
course.
so.
Well, there's a it's an older book by John Blofeld. He was a researcher interested in Tibetan mysticism, and he wrote a book called Mantra. And what he says is, it's not the words. It's not you. It's not the words that are important in the mantra, it's sound. Like you said, the visitors, the sounds, the tones they made, that's what's really transportive. Once we get into words, and I'm not denigrating words, poetry is beautiful. I love poetry. But words kind of remain in the literal. Once we deliteralize, it's like we detach ourselves from our ego and we open up doors of perception that I think are not readily available to us. You've done work with the Monroe Institute using a hemisync, I believe.
I've been to the Monroe
Yeah.
Institute. Have you?
So I've experimented with I did the Triad Mind with Mark Certo, and
What is
so
triad? Well, wait a minute. Before we find that out,
it's
we're
big.
going to have to wait.
Yeah.
Before we find that out, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind, totally new, incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
We're talking to Mike Fiorito. His website, mikefiorito.com. We're talking about UFOs and music. Now, let's pick up the conversation where we just left off a moment ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, so in my research, I began to speak, spoke to different people that are doing spiritual work with sound. So Marla Fries, whom I think you know, Marla?
Yes, I do know
Marla. The American psychic.
Yeah, Marla was a Dreamland host for a while.
Yeah, and so she and I spoke, and she was wonderful, very generous, and she introduced me to someone that did, and I'll get to the Triad Mind, someone that does Gong Yoga in L.A. And so, you know, this it's very interesting because these gongs are chosen, the gongs are made, they are made to hit a certain note. So each gong is designed to hit a certain frequency. And they're used on, often the gongs are selected based upon astrological details. So depending upon season, you know, and so on, time of day. I found that very interesting. And I did some of these, went to some of these sessions. I also did, there's sound baths. So in a like manner, you have someone who leads a meditation using, and it could be, it's usually an assortment. So it could be chimes, bells, gongs. What you find, and I corroborated this in you know, I began reading more into Robert Monroe's work. You have communication with something. You have these hypnagogic things that begin to emerge out of nowhere. And you begin to have an emotional encounter with them. Now, Robert Monroe talks about these things where I think you'd find interesting if you've read his stuff, that the visitors, the encounters he had, first of all, they had a sense of humor. You know, they came fully to life.
The visitors do have a sense of humor. There's no question about that. They do.
And they're kind of they're a little teasing, you know, to Robert Monroe. They were kind of teasing him a little bit, and they were offering instruction. You know, what we need to do as a species. These are things we've heard before. I found that very interesting that during these encounters in sound, he was basically having an encounter with the visitors, not unlike experiences people have reported. And then I came upon Mark Certo's The Triad Mind, which I believe Mark is a sound engineer. He's a musician and a sound engineer. And he worked with Robert Monroe to develop the technology, the hemisync technology. So in this practice, you put on a headset. It's important to put on a headset, and you want to lie down or sit down somewhere. You want to be safe and secure. And with hemisync, you have two frequencies occurring in each ear, two different ones. And it creates this kind of warble effect that essentially puts you in a hypnotic state. And you're going to go somewhere, and you're going to have encounters. You're going to communicate with beings. And that's where it kind of turned for me away from just music. And I started to just go deep into this as sound. And, you know, now the field opens wide, because what I learned is everything emits a frequency. Rocks emit frequencies. You know, when the world is crackling with sound. The oceans, the forests, we're unaware of it. We're kind of sleeping for the most part through much of life often.
I have thought about that, and I've thought that much of the natural world, the animals and the plants, live in an envelope of sound that we don't hear, and that we don't we're not aware of that. And this is why I keep returning to this idea that of the silence that comes when the visitors come near, because it is so profoundly, it feels so sacred, and it can feel more than a little ominous. I want to ask you a question. There's a connection between the UFO experience and this. Can you give us a personal anecdote about how this connection between music and UFO experience works in your life?
I would say as a musician, I sometimes dream in music, and as you know from our previous discussion, I feel that dreams are valid encounter experiences, and I've had UFO experiences where I've had visitations, and it's very psychic, where you're encountering. I'll give one example. I had this dream vision, and it was associated with music, where I'm outside and I see something in the sky, and right away I say, and I often say this, I don't know if you do, if you have UFO dreams, I often say, that's a UFO. And then the UFO kind of morphed. It morphed from this very highly technological looking thing to something more like a 50s looking UFO thing. And then there were it began to move, and then following a trail of it looked like kind of black holes or portals that were a trail that was following this moving UFO object. And there was music, there was sound associated with it. And so that's one of the reasons that got me along this trail. Now, I'm music obsessed. So I listen to music all the time. I'm like kind of analyzing music. I can play the same song over and over for 50 times until my wife pleads with me to please take it off. That's one experience that I've had. I haven't had a UFO experience in an everyday reality experience, like you have, like I've read that you have, and of course many other people have.
Yeah,
But I
we
do,
have them
I,
all the time. It's not
yeah.
an uncommon experience at all anymore. Let me ask you this. Thinking of the UFO experience, the close encounter witnesses, how can music enhance their experience? In other words, what can music, there's a kind of gnosis you mentioned at one point in the book.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that?
I think music is like myth, in that it takes us out of, and I've used the word literal, it takes us out of this, it deliteralizes, and it puts us on a journey. Can you use music to enhance the UFO experience? I don't know if you can force it. I don't know if you can force it, but certainly you can use sound to get out of yourself. You could use sound. I went to a San Pedro, it's written in the book, a San Pedro ceremony. Very rhythmic. There's also singing accompaniment. It was led by a
What exactly is a San
part.
Pedro ceremony?
So San Pedro is like it's an alkaloid like mescaline. It's a very light kind of it's not as powerful as mescaline, peyote. And I should say it's very important that the shamans that were leading the ceremony, this is no plaything. This is very sacred. This is part of their history. You venerate the sacred plants. You go into this with the utmost respect. And actually, people feel that the plants talk to them. So the plants, different kinds of plants speak to you. They impart wisdom to you. They communicate knowledge to you. And so in this experience, it was at night. It was in upstate New York in like the Catskills area. And there were maybe 20-ish people were gathered in a circle. We're led by, they were shamans. There were three brothers. And you consume the San Pedro a few times during the ceremony, and it's intermixed with music and with rhythm, with rhythmic beats. But the rhythmic beats are very hypnotic, and they're very transportive.
The rhythms and the San Pedro work together.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I understand, and you get into another state. Let me ask what you start. We're basically you're a musician. You're very deeply into music as a mystical experience and as a spiritual journey. And I'm not sure that I'm fully understanding where the UFOs side of it comes in here. Can you do you speak to your you haven't had a like a close encounter experience, but there's a sort of I understand where you're coming from here. And what I'm looking for is how, I guess maybe the right question here is, how do you think that music can enhance a close encounter witness's experiences? Because you're talking to somebody who had my last close encounter was this morning at 3 a.m. And it's I'm not alone. I mean, there's used to be a close encounter in my life would happen twice a year, maybe three times. Now it's completely integrated into my life, and that's true of millions of people, thousands of people, probably millions of people. So where is music in this for us?
I think it's part of the, I think it's part of the unconscious experience. I think my feeling on the UFO subject is that it, of course, it's there's no doubt that there's a physical manifestation of something. I mean, you've written about it. You've had, implants. You've had experiences where
I'm
there's
looking at right here,
something
right
fit,
now. Absolutely.
right? And people have experiences where they're burned from, looking too closely at this very electric, high energy, high vibrancy,
That's right. Getting close to
thing.
them when they're turned on is not a good idea.
Right, exactly. But there's also this psychic component, and I think they can be both. And that's really where I'm coming from, is this music has a way to lead us into the collective unconscious. So it takes us out of our out of our everyday experience. It could be something as simple as I remember going my first girlfriend in high school, something like that. As prosaic as that, or as magnificent as I'm pulled into through sound, through music, to an encounter with another being through a psychic channel. And that's really where I'm going, is that I've been rewatching The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell. And if you take the word, you can almost take the word, he's talking about UFOs the whole time. He never mentions it though. But if you rewatch that program, you can take the word UFO and the word myth, and there's some it, you understand the commonality among them. And that's really where I'm coming from. It's this trigger that opens your perceptual field. I don't think you can force it. So I don't know. I think if you use things like hemisync, it's going to happen. If you go to gong yoga, it's going to happen. You're going to get washed over with sound, and you're going to be taken aloft into some realm, into some layer of the collective unconscious. It's just going to happen. You can go in as the most skeptic person, and the instructor that I talked to with the gong yoga instructor, he said, we get I used to get women would come in here with their husbands, and the husband would say begrudgingly, "Well, I really didn't want to come here, and well, I'm coming here for." And then they would leave crying. They would leave with these profound experiences. They could be encounter experiences. It wasn't one kind of thing. It could be a revelation. But it takes you deeper into your unconscious mind, where I think that is a place where the visitors also inhabit. In that layer, they're also there as well.
I think that they manipulate the chemicals in the brain when they're with us. I think that's why you have these extraordinary experiences that are borderline psychedelic. In other words, in order to communicate with them, you have to go to another level. And I've wondered if we could bring music with us, what would happen? I don't know. It's a fascinating thought, though.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting thought, and maybe other people will take the baton and, explore that further.
Well, like, what if you could sing? I mean, I can't sing very well, but I can sing. And what if we were to sing during a close encounter experience? They don't speak, and they do have that voice. I just think it's fascinating that there's a lot we could. I guess what I'm asking here is a bigger question. That there, what is that? We have a place in the universe that is changing right now, big time. We're finally, even the government of all things, as if it was even relevant in this, and I don't think it's very relevant at all. Is admitting that there's something going on. And they will eventually probably come out with things that'll show that they have really spectacularly screwed it up, which is fine. I mean, that's one of the things they do best. And but we're going somewhere. We're going into a new place in the human mind and in the experience of being human and in reality itself. Do we take music with us? And if so, what does that mean? Now, that should be a very simple question, Mike. You can answer it in 3 minutes, I'm sure.
I mean, I think so. I think it's the when we when I've experienced the music that I love the most, a live performance of music, and it could be any kind of music, I feel like this is the highest level of being human. It feels like this is communication. This is some kind of communication. And we can understand music. I could go to another country. I could turn on music from anywhere. I may not like it, but I can understand it. More than that, I may love it. I may be moved by it. So it has that power. And I think what we're finding, and you mentioned the government, and even the conversation has changed. You look at I watched the Cosmosis, and you're on that. We're now beginning to understand this, the role of duplicity in the phenomena. And in a sense, I connect this notion of dreaming to this notion of duplicity, because dream presents itself in the robe of duplicity,
Yeah, can
being
you
deliteralized.
wait, we got to take another break here.
Sure.
We'll be right back. Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us. Because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format, and believe you me, I felt that reading. I put
my life, my memories into it, and I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives.
We're talking to Mike Fiorito, his website, mikefiorito.com. Okay, let's continue where we were just a moment ago.
Sure. So I was just saying that a dream presents itself in the robe of duplicity. And I think we're beginning to understand we're never going to fully understand the phenomena if we keep coming at it in a literal sense. If we keep coming at it with the math that we now have, the math and the science and the materialist point of view that we have, we're never going to get it. That it's not big enough. That tent is not big enough to include the trickster element that it has, the elusive nature of it. And I think, you know, music helps us to navigate that kind of place. Music takes us there. It's part of that. It's part of that that tool set that gets us to the deepest place of being human, like nothing else can.
The deepest place of being human is where we meet the visitors. That's where we meet.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
exactly.
It's in many ways a hard place to be. And one of the reasons that it's so hard to remember these meetings is that that's not a place we go in everyday life at all. That's not where we go. Now, there are implications here. For example, music's got something to do with non-local consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You discuss that, as I recall in the book. I think I'm right. Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, that might have relevance here because when we're getting into non-local consciousness, we're getting into a level of close encounter that has a universality to it. It doesn't have the formal taken aboard. Excuse me, all my stuff's falling off my desk. It doesn't have the formal kind of complicity that you feel when you're taken aboard a craft and there's a sort of sense of the secret about it. And mm-hmm. Sometimes you're very disturbed and very confused. You don't know quite what's happening. I haven't have only had that experience once in my life, but I know people who've had it multiple times. But there's something else here. There is a universality of being that music touches. And I wonder if there's a bridge there between us and the presence. Let's call it the presence, because you really relate to it more psychically and psychologically and in mm-hmm. dreams than you do physically. And I relate mm-hmm. to it in all these ways, but primarily my relationship is physical. So,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I think there's this larger imaginative, you know, field, and it's bound. It's all around us, but we need a trigger. Something has to help us. So, in your case, Whitley, you kind of go there, and not everybody does. It's not everybody is taken there so directly. Some people have to be lulled there. Some people have different experiences, you know, a traumatic experience to be taken there. And I think it is this place, it's this psyche kind of like outside the body. It's this larger, you know, consciousness that is outside us, that it envelops us. We only swim in that ocean. And I do think that music is a language that transcends your everyday language. It's a universal language. I think it's universal beyond humans. I mean, clearly you have you know, birds, they duet. If you listen to mockingbirds, they duet, and you think it's one bird, but studies show that they're going back and forth, and they're communicating. They're actually saying something to each other. We don't know exactly. We only can observe, you know, from the outside. We don't know the content of that. But we believe that there's communication of, where the food is, to, make communication with the larger party. Is there a predator? This kind of thing. So there's this kind of stuff. There's music happening everywhere, and I think that, Whitley, I think that not being aware of it is a part of our regular sleeping through our experience of life. And what the phenomena is trying to do, I think, is to wake us up, is to knock on the door and to say, "Hello, are you awake? Are you paying attention?" We get wrapped up in our little ego worlds where we're so that could be very self-destructive too, and it could be destructive to other people. But getting out of that ego world where maybe you have a little bit of distance, there's a little space between you and your attachments and your greedy attachments. It's interesting that the visitors often give these offer these observations. Why aren't you taking care of the planet? Why aren't you noticing the intelligence that is all around you? Why do you not protect the waters and the environment? These sacred things that really, what they are is who we are. I mean, we are made of the water of rain. We are made of the soil. We are made of, there's nothing about us that didn't come from this earth.
We were made stewards of this planet, and our stewardship is failing. And once it does fail, something changes here. And in other words, if we turn out to be bad stewards, I'm sure the visitors are here in part for that, to
Course
ask,
correct.
yeah, in that. What do you think of that? What do you think will happen if the planetary environment goes haywire in such a way that it's unrecoverable? What do you think happens then?
I mean, termites eat people's houses, right? And
Yeah,
we
they
care
do.
about the termite. Yeah, we care about the termites and other, there's sometimes species when they're out of their niche, their proper environment, and it goes haywire. I think we're kind of that. And yes, I think they're concerned. Who knows what impact nuclear weapons have on worlds that are adjacent or suffused through ours? Who knows what impact? I don't want to say that it's a test, but there does seem to be, if you can't manage your own affairs on your own planet in some kind of civilized way, then how would you be, how could you be allowed into this larger system of intelligences? I mean, we're kind of at the most primitive level.
We are we are at a primitive level, but we're in a situation where you've got to go from primitive to highly sophisticated really fast. And Jake Barber is talking about psionics, as he calls it, and people who can do psionics, and a lot of close encounter witnesses are w realizing that they can control their telepathy. I'm in a couple of groups of people who are becoming telepathic as a group, and and that'll spread. And Kai Dickens and Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell are spreading the word about telepathy among the unvoiced. And the as I point out in The Fourth Mind, the hybrids are also unvoiced and telepathic. And I think the Neanderthals might have been telepathic because they couldn't speak either. They could only make music. I mean, in other words, they could make a sound, but it wasn't, I think it might have been more like the sound the visitors make. A very rich, complex sound, but not a n not communication in a practical sense.
Yeah, and it's maybe closer to a mantra than it is to a word.
Very
And
well
today,
said.
yeah, they have a, what is it, gelatas, if that's how you say it, and they're a type of primate, and they use complex vocal sounds, and they use finely timed call and replies in a way like the way a mockingbird's duet. And so some of this is to some of it does have a practical it does have a practical sense, that of just what is the business of the day? Are we going to move from the spot? Let's huddle and gather. So
Yeah.
some of it has some functional qualities, but it's not literal. I mean, we do this, so we communicate without using words all the time, through facial expressions, through what we don't say. It's I do think that there's a great undiscovered potential there. You talked about being involved in groups that are experimenting and exploring telepathy. I've read it before, but I've reread for a project I'm now working on, Alexandra David Neal, her works on Tibetan mysticism. And she wrote these, I think, in the 20s.
Can you say her name again? There was a little glitch, so why don't you
Sure.
say that sentence again and let me make a note to make a
Sure.
make a
Alexandra David Neal. And she went to Tibet, to like the hinterlands of Tibet, and she went to lamaseries and met students and teachers, acolytes and teachers. And it's interesting because a lot of what in the practice, in this meditation and in these Buddhist practices, so in Tibetan mysticism branch, it was merged with what was indigenous to Tibet, which is, they call it the Banpo religion, which was a kind of shamanism. And not all Buddhists like these traditions. First of all, they're very powerful, and they're magic. So these acolytes, these students would go, they do these deep meditations. You'd go and you sit in a cave. You'd be in dark for long periods of time. And then you would kind of conjure reality. You'd imagine, conjure reality. And first of all, when you come outside of that experience and now you go into the everyday world, your experience of that everyday world is going to be very different, because you've penetrated that veil of how much we co-create the world. And also, people develop skills like telepathy, levitation, by location. They could move at They could vanish, they could disappear. So this is
This
what she's reporting.
is really fascinating because it dovetails into the second part of my book of the Fourth Mind. We need to be able to do these things on a mass scale. We need to become a new species. And you're talking about some people who, can you tell us more about exactly where this happened and what they did?
Sure. So she travels, Alexandra, I'll just call her Alexandra. She travels around Tibet, and she's the student. This has to be in the 20s or 30s, and she gets access to these masters, which is very impressive. This is a long time ago, getting access as an outsider. She learns the Tibetan language. And then she, hears of, say, she hears of a great master, and then she'll make great efforts, sometimes almost inappropriately. She's kind of been canceled in some respects, and I don't think that's fair, just because she is a bit of a colonist, but let's put that aside for a moment.
Well,
So
yeah, but
she.
the thing, my problem with that kind of canceling is they were of their time. Like, I'm from
Of
the South,
course.
and there are people in the
Yes.
South who are always looking into the family histories of trying to find people who were whose families were slaveholders. And yeah, it's easy to do in the South, obviously, but you should not blame people for what they were when that was the right thing to be. In other words, you can't retroactively cancel people. It's not fair.
I completely agree, and there's great art, and there are things that we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. But to get back to the story, she has one experience where she's in search of a monk, and I don't remember their names. They're long Tibetan names, and she's trying to follow him, so she knows that he's on journey. And he is able to move. She can see him moving from a distance. She can actually see the speed that they can run at these incredible speeds. And they can cover a vast amount. Now, Tibet is gigantic. And some of the local people, so even amongst the Tibetan people, you have people say, oh, that's just folklore. That's just folklore. They don't really do that. But some people devoutly believed it. And then you'd have monks that could, they could be so light that they could levitate, they could lift off the ground. I just finished a book. What it was, it They Flew. Jeff
Yes,
Kripal had mentioned it.
it has a huge imp it's having a huge impact. They Flew, folks, is a book about the medieval, basically the medieval levitators, and they did fly. They did fly, because we think of, oh, Joseph of Cupertino supposedly is the Middle Ages. I mean, they were all crazy then. Who knows what it was about, but. When you, Carlos Iyer, the author, goes into this very deeply, and it turns out that these levitators were really carefully observed and researched and analyzed by the Inquisition, which was trying to figure out, are they levitating because they are demonically possessed, or is it God doing it? And of course, the levitators were eager for the Inquisition to discover that it was God, because if they discovered it was demons, then you were going to go up in flames. I mean, it was a pretty serious business. So they were, even one of them, Joseph, as I mentioned, Joseph of Cupertino, levitated in front of the Pope and a whole room full of hundreds of people, all of his cardinals and God knows how many people were around the Pope at any given time in that period. And Joseph is so, he's so overwhelmed, he kneels down to kiss the Pope's feet, and instead he shoots up into the air in front of a whole crowd. And the Pope said, if he dies before I do, I'm going to canonize him. He got canonized, but the Pope, that Pope died before he did. The point being, it's real, and in also mentioned in The Fourth Mind, a friend Paul Eno, who's passed on sadly, actually witnessed in his, with his own eyes a levitation that I describe in the book. It's real. Now, what is it? When you think about it, oh, levitation, it's, yeah, sure, it's real. Or I can't be real. It means that the mind does something, or the heart perhaps, that can do something so profound to the body that the body becomes lighter than air, including the clothes that it's wearing. And if what you're talking about, Mike, we don't know what we are. We don't know our powers. So I want to, this is a long aside, and I like to mostly ask questions in these shows. But I want you to describe very carefully the exact conditions under which these people had these experiences.
So the Tibetan at the lamaseries, the acolytes. So I
Right.
think the important thing, Whitley, is that they would go into deep study. So they would go into practices of meditation, into rumination and meditation upon nothingness. And this is not an easy thing to do, to go into solitary situations. You're cut off from the world, extreme dietary requirements. What happens though, and what really fascinated me, is I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, they are having the kind of psychic experiences that people who have UFO encounters have. And so people who have, they begin to have telepathy. They begin to communicate with their, they don't have to speak to their teacher, their master. They can communicate wordlessly. They can be separated by great distances and be in communication. And by the way, it's not that everyone has every skill, though some people have some skills more than others, but they begin, it comes out of the practice, is the point. That
Well,
they begin to.
people have different skills, and they're called SIDDIS, SIDDIS, and not, not it's I think a rare situation where a single person has them all. The, each one of the things, levitation, moving from one place to another instantaneously. All of those things are cities, and they're real. People do have them, and we did, I think we all had them a long time ago, and we lost them because of a huge catastrophe that hit planet Earth. I don't think it was a war, and I don't think they were taken from us. I think we lost them because of the awful randomness of the universe. I want to shift gears here because we're getting up on we're sucking time here. There are some wonderful stories in the section of the book called Gloria about other people, and I want to explore some of those. How about Lauren Cresanti's? Are you ready to, can you remember and talk about that, for example, and some of those other stories?
Yeah, it's always funny because when you write a book, you I don't know if you have this experience, you don't always readily remember, but I do remember, and I've given reference to Lauren's story. So I met Lauren through I had given a talk somewhere. She wrote to me and said, "I have had experiences with music." She couldn't associate the hospital that she does research for. She's a neurologist. And she lives in the Chicago area. She says she lives near Fermilab. And she had this experience where some sound came thundering over her house. Some, you know, again, not musical in the sense that, of course, it had frequency, but it was more like a magnetic hum. And it, you know, the whole house shook. And she corroborated this with her son, who said, "Yeah, there was something last night. What was that?" And there was also illumination. So oftentimes there's a sound that's also there's an illumination occurring. There's some kind of bright light or brilliant lights that are associated. And she says, "You know, I don't know what it was." And what I didn't do, you'll notice in these stories, I didn't try to explain it. I never tried to explain it. I spoke to this person. I spoke to many people. Not everyone's story got in the book. Like you know, you've spoken to many people. I kind of listened. There were certain things I was looking for, the sobriety of your story. I don't mean that there was drugs involved. I meant you weren't eager to tell me. It was very matter of fact. There was a certain level of maybe dispassionate, and there was a level of detail that it didn't feel made up at all. So this woman had this experience. And then she also had there was some kind of paralysis on her leg. So she was having some kind of electrical stimulation that was happening, I believe, on her leg.
We've got to take another, our third and final break right now. And after we come back, we're going to find out more details about this extraordinary experience. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Streber. I'm Whitley Streber, your host for Dreamland.